attention to each one of them. And thank you very much. And hopefully,
just put it down.
Great. Hopefully, we'll be able to fully appreciate these mitzvot in a way that we haven't before. So that's the goal. There are four sections. I'd like to try to get to each one of them. We may have to summarize some of them. In the ninth chapter of the Megillah, following the conclusion of the story and the events surrounding the Megillah, we read about the establishing of the holiday of Purim through Esther and Mordechai, and we read about the mitzvot that are associated with the holiday. There are actually two different stages, at least, to this development of the holiday of Purim. First, in Pasuk Yutes, we read about Alkena Yudima Prazim Hayoshvim Barei Haprazot Osim Et Yom Arba Asar L'Chodesh Adar Simcha U'Mishtev V'Yom Tov U'Mishloach Manot Ish L'Re'eyu. In this initial iteration, the holiday of Purim seems to be limited to the 14th of Adar, and it seems to resemble a more classic Yom Tov holiday, Simcha U'Mishtev V'Yom Tov. We don't have any mention of Matanos Levionim. And then in Pasuk Chaf Bet, we read about the later iteration of the holiday, Kayamim Asher Nachu Bahem Ayudim Me'Oivehem, V'Achodesh Asher Nehepach Lehem Yagon L'Simcha, U'Me'eva L'Yom Tov La'asod Otam Yimei Mishtev V'Simcha, U'Mishloach Manot Yisra'eh U'Matanos Levion. So we're going to have to try to understand each one of these mitzvos, and the title is More Than Meets the Eye, because I believe, much like the story of Purim itself, the Megillah story, there are multiple layers that need to be unpacked in order to fully appreciate some of the themes and messages that are beneath the surface. When it comes to the mitzvos of Purim as well, there is a great deal that's beneath the surface of the performance, which we can learn to appreciate. So let's first begin with the most prominent, or at least the one that we do twice on the holiday of Purim, the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah. Okay, the basis for this is the fact that the Megillah at the end states, Yamim ha'ilim nizkarim na'asim, these days need to be remembered and observed. The remembering of the holiday of Purim is fulfilled through the reading of Megillah. But what's strange about this particular mitzvah, some of you may have thought about this, some of you may never have thought about this, is that we do it twice. We read the Megillah both night and day. And if you think about it, that is something that's pretty much unique to the reading of the Megillah. There's no other reading that we do twice within a 24-hour period. All the other Megillot we read once on the holiday. Eicha, Shir HaShirim, Kohelet, Rut. We just read them once. We don't read them twice. And even Torah readings we read one time. I guess on fast days we read Vayichal two times. But this is unique in the sense that we are commanded to read it two times. So I want to try to do in the next 12 minutes, because we have about 12 minutes for each one of the mitzvot, is to understand this phenomenon. Why is it that the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah seemingly is redundant? Why can't we just read it once? When did this practice evolve to read it twice? Okay, so we're going to take a look at the primary texts in Masechet Megillah which discuss this, and through that, well, I think this is one of those areas where the development of the halacha, tracing the development through from the earlier rabbinic sources, Mishnah, Gemara, all the way through, allows us to more fully appreciate a conceptual nugget and an idea which is really important for the celebration of the holiday itself. So, interestingly enough, there is no mention in all of the Mishnayot and Masechet Megillah of a nighttime reading. It does not appear anywhere. There's discussion, what do you do if you live in a small village and there aren't 10 people? Do you go in on the market day? Do they come to you on the market day? There's discussion of what time period you're allowed to read the Megillah, only starting with Hanetzachama, with sunrise, and you can read it then the entire course of the day, at any point during the day. But there's never a mention of when you read at night, how you read at night, what those people live in the small villages do. The first time we find this mention is not in the Mishnayot, it's not in the Tosefta, it's not in the Yerushalmi. It appears in the Gemara in source number one in Masechet Megillah in the Talmud Bavli and Dalet Amud Aleph. Join me in reading this particular Gemara, which is fascinating in and of itself. Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Chayav Adam Likros as HaMegillah Balayla V'Lishnosa B'Yom. A person is obligated to read the Megillah at night. V'Lishnota will translate as repeat it, learn it. Who said learn it? Repeat it, learn it, repeat it. It's a little bit unclear what exactly the word Lishnota means, and we'll see in a moment. Because of that ambiguity and what exactly it means, the students of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi were unsure as to what the proper practice was. How do we know this from? He bases it on a verse in Tehillim, which is associated perhaps with the story of Purim. Elokai akra yomam velo ta'aneh. V'laylo v'lo dumiyali. I call out to you during the day, and there's no response, and at night there is no answer. Savermine, they thought, sounds like the students thought, based on this statement by Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, l'mikraya b'layla, to read the Megillah at night, u'lamitna matnitan dida b'yamama, and to study the Mishnayot of Megillah during the day. That would be a very different Purim. You know, just having one reading at night and then sitting down to study in the Mishnayot Megillah by day. Amar lehu Rabbi Yirmiyah, Rabbi Yirmiyah then corrected them and said, no. Lididi mefar sheli minei d'Rav Chiya bar Abba. This was explained to me by Rav Chiya bar Abba. Kegon da'amri inshi. It's like the saying goes, avor parshata da va'atnia. I will read this particular parsha, and then I will repeat it. And then we have another Amora who comes along and says, Itmar Nami, Amr Chelba, Amr Ula Bira, Chayav Adam Likros, the Megillah Balayla, Vilishnota Bayom, Shinemar, a different source, which is interesting, Lamani Zemer Chavov Lo Yidom, Hashem Elokai Lamodeka, those two sources, whether they're adding different dimensions, we won't have time to get into now. It's fascinating. The first source makes it sound like there's two separate mitzvot. There's the Laila and then there's the Yom. And the second source makes it sound like it's an ongoing obligation. L'mayin yizmer chalav v'lo yudom. I just continue to sing your praises. Also, the first source sounds like it's calling out to God and he's not responding. This sounds like we're singing praises. So there's a lot we can make of the two different sources and what the Amoraim are teaching us with those differently mudim. But I want to get back to the basic halacha. Read it at night, then read it again during the day. Which is the primary reading? This is the group participation. What do you think? The first one or the second one? Based on the Gemara? All right, the first one sounds like it's the more important reading. You read that, and then you repeat it during the day. And the truth is, that's kind of filtered down into how we practice. Purim night, shul's packed. This year it's a Sunday, so hopefully everyone will come back per morning, but kind of in terms of how Jews have come to practice Purim nights, kind of the night, and it also makes sense, it's the first opportunity to hear it. But, here's the but, even though it almost is implied by this Gemara, Likrota Megillah B'Lai V'Lishnota B'Yom, and they thought maybe to not even read during the day, it sounds like, according to almost every single Rishon, with maybe two or three exceptions, the primary reading is the day reading, not the nighttime reading. Now, this is very important because it means that we got to go hear the Megillah twice, both at night and during the day. And if we have to choose, some people think you should choose the daytime reading over the nighttime reading, because that's the primary reading. And there are a lot of halachic ramifications of this. This is why, according to Ashkenazic practice, we're allowed to recite Shechiyanu again during the day. A, it covers the other mitzvot, but B, the primary reading may be during the day. This is significant in a number of different ways. The most important is to realize that the primary reading is the daytime reading. Okay. There are some exceptions. The Rambam seems to imply that the two readings are of equal status and stature. The Rokeach actually says that the nighttime reading is primary. But other than those two, really, there's unanimous kind of consensus that indeed the daytime reading is the primary reading. But it's not only that. We can go further than that. As I mentioned before, if you look through the Mishnayot in Masechet Megillah, you find no mention of the nighttime reading. I have three examples here. The Mishnah in the second parak on Daf Chaf. Ein Kornes HaMegillah V'lo Malam V'lo Tovim V'lo Mazin V'chein Shomeres Yom Kenegi Yom Lo Titbo Ad Shetenei Tzacham. You can't read the Megillah until it's dead. Until sunlight. Until sunrise. Similarly, the Mishnah in the first parak, which talks about the different days you can read the Megillah, makes no mention of nighttime reading. And then probably the most explicit Mishnah we have in source 4, Parak Bet Mishnah, Hey, Kol Ayom Kasher L'Kriya Megillah. The entire day you can read the Megillah, and then it goes through a litany of other mitzvahs which are permitted to be done throughout the course of the day, Netilat Lulav, etc. And then the very next Mishnah, Mishnah 5, says, Kol Alayla Kasher L'Ktzirat HaOmer L'Hekter Chalav Me'Evarim Zeh Kol Davar Shem Mitzvah V'Yom Kasher Kol Yom Davar Shem Mitzvah B'Layla Kasher Kol Alayla. So the Mishnah lists mitzvahs that are done by day can be done all day, and here's a list of mitzvahs that can be done at night, and they can be done at any time throughout the night until sunrise the next day. What's noticeably absent from that list is Mikra Megillah. We had the daytime Mikra Megillah. Why did we leave out the nighttime Mikra Megillah? Okay. So the Turei Evin, who is a very significant acharon on Megillah, on this Gemara, explains that actually, when even though the Gemara initially implies perhaps that the nighttime reading is primary, according to the final conclusion of the Gemara, this is source number 5, Ulamaskana zumash meshachayv l'kroz the Megillah b'layla v'chozer v'kor b'yom v'nirali d'hai kriya d'layla eino ela midrabanan. The nighttime reading is only merely d'rabanan. It's of a lower status than the daytime reading. V'eino ikar chiyu sharuach hakodesh. And then he proves it based on a number of the things that we've talked about, and the fact that all the other mitzvot are performed during the day, and he mentions Shechion, and there are other halachic ramifications based on this. One last source, Rav Shlomo Mivilna in source 6, actually takes this argument to its logical conclusion and makes a point that probably any academic scholar of the Mishnah in Talmud would make, which is that there wasn't a nighttime reading of the Megillah. Initially, the Megillah was read one time. When was it read? During the day. You know why the Mishnah never mentions anything about nighttime readings? Because at the time of the Mishnah, they only read the Megillah during the day. Source number 6. V'o nir li v'hu ha'ikar lufyaniya daiti dibizman ha'mishnah adayin lo haya ha'takana likrosa Megillah gam b'layla. The Hava Megillah in the Megillah text itself, lo huskar rak yamim, the rak d'bimei Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, so he suggests that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi himself, or in the times of Yeshua ben Levi, or maybe the generation beforehand, hitkinu shiukorin gam b'layla, v'samchu akra, etc. The teida, the lo huskar b'shum duchta b'mishnah kriyas Megillah shalayla. The question then becomes, if the Turei Evin and the Binyan Shlomo are correct, and I believe it's quite plausible. Now, most Rishonim assume that there always was a Kriya at night, but the primary one is during the day. But I think if the Binyan Shlomo is correct, we have a very important question to try to figure out. If the primary reading of the Megillah is the daytime reading, why did they institute a nighttime reading, which pretty much can steal the thunder, and does steal the thunder, of the daytime reading? Right? Why not have two times, I don't know, during the day? We've set up a scenario where the primary reading, which is done during the day, is going to almost be an afterthought, it would seem. So that's the key question that I want to try to deal with. If, in fact, the development of the practice of reading the Megillah is, as the Binyan Shlomo states, that initially there was just the daytime reading, and subsequent to that, in the times of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, right before then, they instituted a nighttime reading. Why have a nighttime reading? What was the impetus for that? What was the significance of that? And why risk undermining the daytime reading? So here's a theory that I think will hopefully add to our understanding of the Megillah and this mitzvah of Kriyat HaMegillah, and also to the holiday of Purim. The Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda of Berlin, in his commentary on that particular Gemara, explains exactly what the Hava Mina was. He actually says they didn't actually think that they didn't have to read the Megillah during the day. They initially thought that they would have to read the Megillah during the day and study the Mishnayot. Why would they think that? So here he explains. Perush. Milvad kriyat hamigila shu kumo minat Torah chayev lishanot. Upirish hamikra lo kayakra yomam havi kilashon hamikra muva bebrachot minayin leberchas Torah minat Torah shenemar kishem Hashem ekra. Amrlu Rabbi Yirmiya kagon daamri inchi evor parsha dadu the atnia. Upirish vlishnota ditzarech liyot hakriya. The daytime reading, the primary reading, needs to be biyidiyah shel habiur lahavin lahaskilba. It's important that that daytime reading be a reading which is done with knowledge and understanding and investigation. V'havizek kemo shelomi parsha. It's like when someone reviews a text or a Torah portion, debapama rishon over alei belini tuach hamamarim. The first time you read through it, you want to get a sense of the story, what's going on, well, what are the facts. But then the second time, b'shasha over shenit hu sam lev lahaskil yoter alei. Kach b'chiyuv kriyat ha-megillah b'yom yesh l'dakdek b'machshavata yoter mi-balayla mishum hachi k'tiv kilashon mitzvah she'en li kuvo kokach. The Netziv says, what's the significance of the double reading? The double reading, we instituted a first reading at night so that the primary reading during the day would be done as a reading that's not just a superficial, you know, washing over you or just hearing the story or reading it and not being familiar with it. But the daytime reading is supposed to be done with familiarity, with an understanding of the events of the story so that one can study it. Lishnota doesn't just mean to repeat. It means to study, to learn. The daytime reading of the Megillah is the primary reading because it's a learning reading. The nighttime reading, it seems to be just about establishing familiarity. The daytime reading, on the other hand, is about going beyond familiarity, digging in deeper into the text and understanding of the story. Now, this could be because the Megillah itself is a very layered text. Megillat Esther, besides all the parallels to other biblical texts, the allusions and all these talks we've had at this Yom Iyun, have probably explored some of them. The Megillah, even though on the surface it seems almost like a childlike story or a satire or whatever it is, when you dig deeper, there's so many layers there. So I think one part of this is that the story of Megillat Esther is there's a lot beneath the surface, and so there is a great advantage in having a second reading, and that second reading being that time where you can excavate and dig a little deeper. But I think beyond that, this gets into the rabbinic view of Purim, there's something emblematic about having a double reading specifically on Purim, and for us to institute a preparatory reading at night in order to make that second reading, the primary reading, one which is done with more proactive understanding and initiative. And that is based on the Gemara in Shabbat, which tells us that the time of Purim was not just the time where we experienced salvation from Haman, but it was also a time where the Jews, of their own initiative in exile, reaccepted, reestablished the covenant and reaccepted the Torah. The Gemara in Shabbos in source number 8 explains that initially, and this is a complicated Gemara, the Torah was accepted in some kind of coercive fashion. But at the end of the Gemara, Rava says, Afal Pikin, even if that was the case initially, Hadr kiblu bimea chashverosh nechsiv kiblu vikiblu hayuhudim kimu masha kiblu kfar. The holiday of Purim, through the rabbinic lens, is a holiday not just of salvation from our enemy, physical survival. It's also a day of rededication of the covenant and establishing the fact that the Torah is ours and we willingly accept it and participants in the active unfolding of our covenantal faith with this Torah. And so in a certain sense, as a microcosm of this idea, I think the nighttime reading is instituted so that that daytime reading, again, which is the primary reading, becomes one where we show and demonstrate this kind of dedication to the study of Torah, dedication to our covenant with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore, by instituting this nighttime reading, we've added an extra depth and dimension to the daytime reading. So mitzvah number one, the mitzvah of Kriyat HaMegillah, what we've hopefully learned is that the Megillah reading at night is really a setup. It's really supposed to prepare us for a more advanced, a more proactive reading during the day. Lishnota, the daytime reading, should be a learning experience. It should be a moment where we're demonstrating this other motif of Purim, of rededication of our Torah commitment through the study of Torah, through the study of this particular text. That's mitzvah number one. Okay? Let's go on to mitzvah number two. There's much more to say about each one of these mitzvot, but I really want to try to give us a sense of all of the, each one of the mitzvot of Purim. Let's talk a little bit about Mishloach Manot Ishareyu. Now, this too is something which is unique to Purim. Matanos Lavyonim, we're going to see later on, has a special Purim twist, but the concept of giving to the poor is something that we're familiar with year-round, and it's associated with holidays, Moschitim, and tzedakah during the Aseret Yemei Tshuva. It's not some unique phenomenon. And even the Suda of Purim is something which is not very unique in the sense that each holiday we eat and we celebrate through that fashion. But Mishloach Manot Ishareyu is something which is really unprecedented in the Jewish holiday constellation. So what is the focus? What is the purpose of Mishloach Manot Ishareyu? So if you take a look at the first few sources that I have for you on this, there are really two primary ideas which emerge about the mitzvah Mishloach Manot, and this is, again, the conventional part, and then hopefully we'll be able to dig a little deeper for some more depth and an understanding. There are three questions that are asked about Mishloach Manot which impact our practice and which illuminate the two different basic concepts of what Mishloach Manot is about. We try to kind of combine these, both of these concepts, and fulfill all the opinions. Those three questions are as follows. One, the question of the Trumas Hadeshen, we'll do this outside. Question of the Trumas Hadeshen, am I allowed to give someone, you know, I have someone in my neighborhood who's a huge electronic guy, big time, and we're close to him. If I got him an iPad 2 and something else for Mishloach Manot, as opposed to whatever challah roll and grape juice bottle that I plan on giving, he would be a lot happier. That would really be something that would be tremendously meaningful to him, and it would mean a lot to him. So the Trumas Hadeshen was asked this question. What happens if I give someone some sheets or some clothing or an iPad for Mishloach Manot? Does that count? That's one question. Second question. What happens if I give someone Mishloach Manot and they refuse to accept it? That same friend has, he's got gluten issues and other kinds of things. Let's say I bring over a challah to him and brownies, and I say, here, happy Purim, whatever. He's like, oh, well, you know, thank you, I appreciate it, but I can't eat that stuff. It's not good for me. My kids can't eat it, whatever. We don't allow junk in the house. I don't know, whatever you want to say. So have I filled my mitzvah Mishloach Manot if I've delivered and given, but they haven't been accepted and received? Third, let's say I go out on Purim to deliver my Mishloach Manot, and somebody in the interim comes to my house, and nobody's home, nobody answers the door, and they leave the Mishloach Manot on my front porch, and then the card that's with it blows away in the wind. I come home, and I say, wow, somebody dropped off this lovely turkey and wine bottle, but I have no idea who it is. Has that person fulfilled their mitzvah Mishloach Manot? Those are the three questions that illuminate what Mishloach Manot is really all about. So there are two basic views of Mishloach Manot. One, the view of the Trumas Hadeshen, is that Mishloach Manot is really about facilitating su'udot, facilitating the Purim meals for everyone around the table. And in general, Manot usually indicates foodstuffs. In Nehemiah, v'shilchu manot le'ein nacholmo, go, yichlu mashman v'shisu mamtak, I'm talking about Rosh Hashanah in that context, send things to people who need them. So Mishloach Manot is similar to kind of Matano Levionim in the sense that it's about facilitating people who are in need, but it's a way of people not having to reach out for the money. And this way, everybody kind of gets the food that they need for the Suda. So if you go through it, you wouldn't fulfill your obligation if it was with food. You would fulfill your obligation if you gave it and the card blew away because I helped that person have their Suda. And I'm not so sure about the case where the person refused it. Probably not, because if they're not using it for their Suda, then you haven't really fulfilled your mitzvah. Okay. However, there is a second view. This is the view of Rav Shlomo Alkibitz, quoted by, who's the author of Lechadot, quoted by the Chasam Sofer and others on page 2, source number 2. And that is the view, the Sefer Manos Halevi, that the idea of Mishloach Manot is to add shalom and reyut, to add feelings of unity and achdut and camaraderie and love and fellowship, etc. Now, if that's the case, the iPad works great. All right? And perhaps even if someone refuses the gift, but I've given it to them, that probably establishes that kind of relationship, especially if they say, listen, I really appreciate it, but we've got too much stuff. You know, we've already got Pesach's in 4 weeks. I can't have any more Kit Kats in my house. It's just too much. So, again, you've facilitated, you've achieved the goal of Shalom Reyes, even if they haven't accepted it. What about if the person doesn't know who delivered it, who gave it to them? Then it's maybe an open question. Ksav Sofer says, no, it wouldn't work because it's only Ish L'Re'eu. There has to be an interpersonal sense of who gave it to me. I have to know who the person was that gave it to me, and that's how you increase the Ahava and the Achva and the Re'ut. You could say that, no, there's kind of a global or more general good feeling that I have inside when I see someone delivered something to me, even if I don't know who it is. Okay. So the question is, how far can we go with this notion of the mitzvah Mishloach Manot really being about facilitating camaraderie and friendship and the like, and where it comes from? So the most extreme position on this issue is the Bach in source number 7, the commentary on the Torah. A little background. Rashi says that there's a story in the Gemara about two Amoraim who apparently were indigent and didn't have much money, and they would cook their own cook meals for themselves and then switch in order to feel Mishloach Manot. That's what the story sounds like. Rashi says no. The story is 1 year one would cook and the other one would come to their house, and the next year the other one would cook and vice versa. So the problem with that position is, how does that fulfill my obligation of Mishloach Manot this year? If I cook and you come to my house, okay, so maybe I fulfill Mishloach Manot because you have partaken of my Suda, but how do you fulfill your Mishloach Manot by coming to my Suda? So the Bach says something amazing. Bach, in source number 7, quotes Rashi and says, "Aval Rashi zal, because of zel l'shonam mechalfin suda sayu, zel ucholim zel, bepurim shal shana zu, ubishniya soed chaver imo, umash v'sharot zelomar shalo hayu sholchin zel l'zel. Upshita she'en shanam shniya mo'il lahotzi et chaveri dei chobat mishloach manot mishana shavra." How could it be that next year he gets credit for, this year he gets credit for what he's going to do next year for me? We work out this arrangement. You come to me this year, next year I'll go to you. Does that fulfill your Mishloach Manot this year? Ela kachu aperush, dekivan detam Mishloach Manot, hu kidei shiyehe sameach, v'sas im ohava, v'reyav, u'lahashkin b'nehem ahava, v'yachva, v'reyut, im kenim yisod echarim chavero v're'eyu, harei heim besimcha u'betuv lev mishle yachad, u'pturim heim me'ata michiyuv Mishloach Manot. This is a pretty wild shita. I don't know if we pass them like this, but it demonstrates how far we go with this idea. The Bach says it's slightly antinomian. You know, it's not at all action-oriented. The Bach says, listen, the whole purpose of this mitzvah is to facilitate love and friendship and camaraderie and everything else. So if we have our suda together, we're enjoying each other's company. You come to my house this year. Next year I go to your house. But the very fact that we're sitting down together and having this meal together, that's good. We're pater from Mishloach Manot. Wow, that's pretty wild. That's pretty remarkable. So what I want to try to do in the remaining several minutes we have for Mishloach Manot is to try to speculate as to why there is this emphasis on brotherhood, specifically during Purim. Why this achva, the reyut, and ahava could be so powerful that according to the Bach, it's sufficient even without actually delivering items. This goes beyond the iPad. This basically says, I love you, you love me, we celebrate together, and so now we're good. So I want to try to suggest that that this is not a coincidence. That in fact, this is another layer that we can uncover about the Purim story. So the conventional way of saying this is that this is tied into this idea, this notion of brotherhood and Achva and Reyut is tied into the Purim story because of the threat to the Jewish people and the formulation that Haman has for that threat. What does Haman say back in the beginning of Megillah? Yeshno am echad mefozar mefarav ben amim. There are these people who are spread out amongst the nations, which has been interpreted as they themselves are divided. There's divisiveness amongst the Jews. Wow. Hard to believe that at that time, the rabbis suggest, there were these divisions amongst Jews. So that, according to this rabbinic view, is a reason for the vulnerability to Haman's threat. Because we are divided, that's part of what Haman's saying. That's part of the reason why we're put in the potential calamity that befell us. Aha. What's the antidote for that? What's the corrective? Esther says, Lech knos et kol ha-yudim. Gather all the Jews together. Okay. Beautiful idea. Part of the way in which we correct the divisions is by gathering all the Jews together. We're all fasting, all for one and one for all. Great. But I think it's even deeper than that. Okay? This I have not suggested before, but we're going to try to suggest it now. I think that there's more than just this Yeshno Am Echad Mefuzar Mefurad. I think that there, and again, this comes from that second reading of the Megillah. If you read through the Megillah with a little deeper appreciation of what's going on underneath the text and some of the themes that are there and alluded to without explicitly the hidden meanings of the Megillah. I think there's a running theme throughout the Megillah which has perhaps been overlooked and which Mishloach Manot is designed to help commemorate. If you think about the Megillah, this is a mini Megillah shiur now. If you think about the Megillah, we have these verses which we say aloud, which are a little strange. They're always about Mordechai, pretty much. Ish Yehudi Ayav Shushan Abira, right? And then when Mordechai goes out and dressed all fancy, we say that one out loud, and then we say that next pasuk, Vayehudim Haytar, but that seems to be one. And then the last verse, I'm not talking about the Aser B'nei Haman, there might be a different reason why we say that out loud. That might be because we don't fulfill our obligation, etc. Then we do the last verse out loud. So I've always wondered what's the significance of all those verses and why we're focusing on Mordechai and what's so important about Mordechai. So I want to suggest a theory to that question. So let's go back to the first incidence of Ish Yehudi. Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan HaBirah Shmu Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish Ish Yehudi. Source number 12. There's a certain tension in this pasuk that all the commentators note, which is, where is Binyamin from? Where is Mordechai from? Is he from Shevet Yehuda? Is he from Shevet Binyamin? Why is he called Ish Yehudi? Why is he called Ish Yimini? Remember, this is in Tanakh, Yehudi usually means that you're from Shevet Yehuda, right? It's only been a little while since the 10 Shvatim left, and the two Shvatim that are remaining, Yehuda and Binyamin, have been exiled. There are some instances where the Jews collectively are called Jews Yehudim, but the Megillah is one of the first times that we find that phenomenon. So Rashi notes in source number 13 that the Ish Yehudi seems to be a bit of a misnomer. Ish Yehudi al shegala im galut Yehuda kolatan shegalu im alchei Yehuda hayu kruyim Yehudim ben agayim v'afilu mishevet acherim. Even if you were from Shevet Binyamin, since the dominant tribe that left Israel, that was exiled, was from Shevet Yehuda, they were all called Yehudim. Good. Rashi, though, if we continue on page number 3, states, Ish Yimini min Binyamin hayakach pshuta. The truth is, the pshat is he was from Binyamin, but even though he's from Shevet Binyamin, Ish Yimini, he's identified kind of in this somewhat contradictory fashion, Ish Yehudi, Ish Yimini. Okay. I think, however, that Chazal, and the truth is, I think there's some hints to it in the text itself, and this is one of them, that Chazal here pick up on not just, oh, the Ish Yehudi is a little bit misleading, but that there really is a connection here to Shevet Yehuda, and maybe even more so to the character of Yehuda himself. Take a look at source number 14. This is a medrash on Esther, which picks up on this. V'chi haya mishevet Yehuda v'lo mishevet Binyamin haya. Wasn't he from Binyamin? Why do they identify him that? Shnemar Ish Yimini. Ma ra akasav shekaro Yehudi ela sheyardu mitzrayim etzel Yosef. V'ra Binyamin imahim. The medrash now goes on to tell this whole story. That when the Jews went to Egypt, when the tribes, the Shvatim went to Egypt, meaning the brothers went down to Egypt, Binyamin ended up getting taken. He had the gviya in his hamtochtav. He had the goblet in his bag. Things were bad. And what happened? Who stepped up? It's a beautiful medrash. Yehuda stepped up. Why did Yehuda step up? Because he had made a promise, and he says, "Lama ki avdecha arevet anar miyim avi." I promised, and therefore, Amar le Hakadosh Baruch Hu. Two lines from the bottom. Atama sarta nafshecha le'eved tachad lavot tachad binyamin. You were moser nefesh, that you were willing to serve instead of binyamin for Yosef. Chayecha hagoel she'atid la'amod yisrael l'shimcha ani kotvo l'kach ne'amar yishudi. The person is going to come along at the end of many generations to save the Jewish people. I'm going to call him Ishiudi. That's very strange, right? Because Yehuda did something then, now Mordechai is called Ishiudi, even though he's not really Ishiudi. We call him Ishiudi because we're paying homage to something that Yehuda had done several hundreds and hundreds of years ago. It's very strange. Number two, Medrash number two, the Esther Rabbah. The Megillah states, V'haman, V'hamelech V'haman Yashvu Lishtot. According to Esther Rabbah, this isn't just a random phrase. This goes back to, again, Yosef and his brothers. Not just the story of Yehuda stepping forward. This goes back to the story when Yosef was sold. What did the brothers do? Sit down to eat. Okay? And the Medrash concludes, Shehare ad yemei Mordechai, ota onesh shel mechirat Yosef kayam. The onesh for, the punishment for mechirat Yosef was still there until the days of Mordechai. What happened in the days of Mordechai that ended it? I guess that the Jews were imperiled by Haman, but they didn't actually get the punishment. Why did they avert the punishment in that generation? Ad yemei Mordechai, but the too low, it sounds like. Okay, lastly, when Mordechai tears his garments, Vayikra Mordechai Begadav, the Midrash sees this not just as a random act, but that this also is payback. Reb Pinchas b'shem Reb Oshia Amar Shvatim Garmu Lahem La'aviyam Likara. The tribes, meaning the brothers, caused their father to tear his garment. Shenemar Vayikra Yaakov Simlo Sav. V'heicha Nifra Lahem. When were they paid back? Vayikru Simlo Sav. When they tore their garments immediately upon hearing that Binyamin had this givi in his cup, in his bag. Menashe garm l'shvatim likara. This is the Midrashic view that Menashe was the one who was acting on Yosef's behalf in that whole story. He caused them to tear their garments. L'fikach nikru nachlato. This is very interesting. Because he did what Yosef told him to do, therefore his nachala, his inheritance, was split in Israel. Very interesting. Chetzi b'Eiver Yarden, chetzi b'Eretz Kanan. Binyamin garm l'shvatim likara. Now Binyamin didn't really do anything, right? How did he cause them to tear their garments? Okay. Amad ben Beno uparalo, but that was eventually paid back when his great-great-great-grandson tore his garment, shenemar vayikra Mordechai, when Mordechai tears his garment. So what's going on here? How do we understand all these seemingly strange references and allusions to the brothers of Yosef, Yehuda, Binyamin, etc.? I think it all goes back to Ishiudi, Ishimini. And I think, again, we don't have time to get into all of the details of the methodology of biblical allusion and literary parallels and when they are convincing, when they're not. I think the Megillat Esther has so many parallels that even new putative parallels that haven't been suggested are much more likely to be genuine because of the fact that the author of Megillah is intending clearly to make a number of parallels. What is the significance here? So I think there's just one more parallel which helps us understand and appreciate what's going on. If you remember, Esther has succeeded apparently in her mission. Haman is dead. Good news. But it's not good news. Because even though Haman is dead, if you read the whole latter third of Megillah, Esther's still crying and pleading and begging Ahasuerus to save the Jews. Why is she doing that? Because the Jews aren't safe yet. The Jews have a decree hanging over their heads. Ahasuerus doesn't undo the decree. Esther has revealed herself. Mordechai has revealed himself. Mordechai and Esther have Beit Haman. They seem to be safe. But Esther nevertheless still goes ahead and says, I'm not going to rest now. It's not about me and my family being safe. It's not about me and Mordechai and the descendants of Ish Yemini being safe. It's about the whole entirety of the nation being safe. So in a certain sense, what Esther does is very similar to what Yehuda did for Binyamin. Esther sacrifices or is willing to sacrifice her life. She again enters into Ahasuerus' chamber. He extends the scepter again, thankfully, and says, "You have to save my people, not just me." Right? He actually doesn't do that right away. He says, I can't overturn the decree. You can write whatever you want and try to kind of overwhelm the decree, and that's what they do, but I can't overturn it. That's a story for another time. But what Esther does, her action, especially the second action, when she goes back to Ahasuerus in Perek Ches and begs for the safety and protection of the rest of the Jews, she's putting her own life on the line for the safety of others. She's probably perfectly safe right now. So she, in a certain sense, is acting as Yehuda did. And it's not just a random coincidence. There's actually an allusion to it. If you look at sources 17 and 18, this is the paragraph of what Esther says and compare it to what Yehuda says when he's willing to give up his own freedom for Binyamin. Esther says, "Ki eichacha uchal v'ra'iti b'ra'a asher yimtza dami ve'eichacha uchal v'ra'iti b'avdan maladati." And Yehuda says, "Ki eich ele elavi v'hanar eineni iti penere b'ra asher yimtza davi." And if you read those two psukim over and over again, you'll see there are a lot of similarities in the words that they use. Esther says, how can I witness this tragedy befall my people? Yehuda says, how can I witness this tragedy befall my brother and my father? Remember, Yehuda's act is incredibly, incredibly difficult thing to do. He's basically admitting that his father really only loved passionately Rachel, Yosef, and Binyamin. This is his real passion and his real family. You can't do this. It'll kill him, and I can't see that happen to my father. Yeah, it'll be fine for me and for my brothers and the sons of Leah, but this will really kill my father, and I can't see that. Esther, similarly, says, it'll be fine for me, but I can't witness what happens to the people. And I think that's why the story of the Megillah and the mitzvah Mishloach Manot is really about reconciliation and the entirety of the Jewish people coming together. Even if it's from different family, tribes, and whatever it is, the mitzvah Mishloach Manot is really a way of expressing this deeper connection. It's not just Lech Knosa Kol Yudim. It's let's get over the familial tribal divisions that have always existed. The Ish Yudi, the Ish Yemini. Let's forget that and let's try to come together as a whole. Let's try to come together. Whatever's left of us, Yehuda, Binyamin, we're from different mothers, but who cares? Let's now try to work together. And here, this is the smoking gun for this. If you walk away with anything today, walk away with this. I think this is phenomenal. If you look at the last pasuk in the Megillah, what do we hear about Mordechai? Ki Mordechai Yehudi, who again was the inspiration for Esther to put her life on the line, now he's just Mordechai Yehudi, interestingly enough. Mishne lemelech Achashverosh, he's second in command. V'gadol Yehudim, v'ratzui l'rov echav. Now that's a very loaded phrase. Some people say it means not everybody liked him. The Targum says the Shevet Binyamin people didn't like him, which is interesting. His own brothers didn't like him because they thought he was caring too much about the rest of the people. Very interesting. And then we read, Doresh Tov Le'amo, he sought good for his people. V'dover Shalom L'chozero, and he spoke peacefully or peaceably about everybody. Okay, listen to this. This is a good chop. I haven't seen this anywhere, but I think it's great. Source number 20, all the way at the beginning of the Yosef and the brother's story. We read, Vayiru achav ki oto ahav avihem mikol achav, vayisnu oto v'lo yachlu dabro l'shalom. Think about it. Dover shalom l'chol zaro, v'lo yachlu dabro l'shalom. Right? The story of the Megillah, the story of Mordechai and Esther, is the story of finally now the Jews are able to talk to each other and speak peaceably about everybody. Before the brothers, the whole story of Yehuda and Yosef and the brothers is based on this fact that they can't even talk about each other. They can't even say good things about each other. They don't worry about each other. Yehuda first does it for Binyamin, and then in the ultimate reconciliation, and the final rectification of those divisions, Mordechai and Esther represent this idea of Dover Shalom L'chol Zaro, the brothers who initially couldn't even talk to each other now form one big happy family. And I think that that adds, hopefully, another dimension to our Mishloach Manot. I got 7 minutes left. Let's go very quickly. Just talk about the Sudan Matana Levion. We can do this. Okay? The Sudat Purim. So, let's talk about what we know about the Sudat Purim. So the Sudat Purim, certainly, Yimishtev Simcha, it's already in the Megillah. It's really an important element of the holiday. Why is it so important? So the conventional explanation is, it's important because we were threatened, our physical lives were threatened. The Levush articulates this and contrasts it with Hanukkah, why we don't have a Suda obligation on Hanukkah. On Purim, our lives were threatened, our lives were in danger. Therefore, we celebrate physically, and we celebrate through drinking even. We do all those things on Purim as a way of expressing our joy at being alive, etc. Okay, I'd like to add a dimension to this. And it's based on some things we've talked about already, okay? And that is that the holiday of Purim and the feast on Purim is not merely about the physical salvation of the Jewish people, but it is also a way of commemorating that rededication of the covenant. What does that have to do with Suda? Well, the first time the Jews got the Torah, we read in Parsha Mishpatim about a great feast that was had, based on a covenantal feast. Moshe sprinkles the blood on the people, sprinkles the blood on the Mizbeach. They have Vayizbechu Zvachim Shlamim, they have Shlamim, they Vayachu Vayishtu. One of the things we do when we, and this is perhaps uniquely Jewish, when we celebrate a covenant, and when we celebrate any special occasion, is we sit down and we eat. That's why in Shavuos, I think, we have an obligation to eat, kind of commemorating Matan Torah. So I think another dimension to the Suda on Purim is not just the physical salvation, but it's also this idea of the rededication of the covenant. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein says something similar to that in Source Number 4. Let's now talk about Matanot Levionim. We have all of 6 minutes for this. This, I think, is very important. Very important, and again, requires more elaboration. Matanot Levionim. What's Matanot Levionim? So two conventional views again. Some people say, well, it's a mitzvah of tzedakah. You know, every holiday we try to give tzedakah for those who are less fortunate, so that they can have what they need, etc. Others tie it into the Mishloach Manot, into the Suda of Purim, so that the poor people can have enough for Suda. I want to try to add another dimension to this, and I think this goes back to the Mishnayos and the Gemara as well. There is, even though we would probably, if we were asked to say, pair up the four mitzvot of Purim, right, put them in two pairs, what would you do? I'd probably say Mishloach Manot and Matanot Levionim go together because they're kind of like similar things, and then you have the mitzvah of Megillah and maybe the Suda. I don't know how you pair them up. But the Mishnah and the Mishnayos and Megillah pair up Mikra Megillah and Matanot Levionim. Ein bein adar rishon l'adar sheni ala kriyat ha-Megillah Matanot Levionim. Whenever you have Mikra Megillah, you have Matanot Levionim. So if there are times where you can't do Matanot Levionim, let's say Shabbos, you can't have Mikra Megillah, the Gemara says, because you need to have Megillah and Matanot Levionim together. Good. Why are they joined at the hip? So the Gemara and the Tosefta has a very interesting formulation for this. Rav Yosef says, "Mipnei she'einehem shel aniyim nesuot b'mikra Megillah." The eyes of the poor are focused, or literally raised up, on the Megillah. So this could just mean, listen, when is the crowd around for them to collect money? When you're reading the Megillah. So they're paying attention to when the Megillah is read. So you have to have the Matanos Levionim on the same day that you read the Megillah. So if there's a Purim Meshulash, whenever you do Mikra Megillah, you do Matanos Levionim. If it's Shabbos and you can't do Matanos Levionim, you also can't do Mikra Megillah. The two are joined at the hip. But I think if we look carefully at the mitzvah Matanos Levionim, we'll see that there's a reason for this connection to Mikra Megillah, and that it's not just typical tzedakah, and it's not just about giving poor people enough for the Su'udan Purim. What then is it about? Here's the first couple of hints. The Yerushalmi, codified by the Rambam, says that anybody who extends their hand on Purim you give to them. That is not the normal halach when it comes to tzedakah. We're not supposed to give charlatans. You don't have to necessarily be the FBI and do a full background check on somebody. But the reason why we have two dote or some communities do different things, we want to make sure that the money's going to people who really need the money. That's an important part of tzedakah. Purim, you better walk around with singles because anybody who extends their hand, you're supposed to give to them. Kola poshet yad, notin mo ve'in medaktikin. You're not medaktik. Furthermore, the mo to Purim, the Purim fund, the Matanos Levionim fund, cannot be switched over to any other fund. If you give Matanos Levionim to a rabbi's discretionary fund, he can't use it to support somebody's Pesach Seder. It's not generic charity. It has to remain separate and distinct. You can't even count it as Meister money, etc. What does all this demonstrate? So in 1 minute, what I think it demonstrates, it gets to the core of the difference, or the potential difference, between Evyon and Ani. Matanot Levyonim, we think they're synonymous, Evyon, Ani, what's the difference? The Gemara Bamitia says that there is a difference. That an Evyon is not embarrassed to ask. An Evyon is loksif l'mitpeh. They're not embarrassed to ask. So it could be that they're so poor they're not embarrassed to ask, but I don't think it's a function of them being more poor. It's a function of them being so down, them being so lacking so much self-image and so much self-esteem that they've lost hope. In a certain sense, they're even willing to beg for money. And Ani retains that pride. He may be indigent more so than anybody else, but he won't ask for it because he maintains that pride. Now on Purim, there is one opinion that says that you should specifically give to Evyonim, those who are asking, and not necessarily to Aniyim, which is interesting. The Aruch HaShulchan says that's not the case, but what's the idea here? So I think the idea of Matanos Levyonim is it's not just about giving money to the poor. It's just about giving money to the poor, you should make sure they're actually poor, right? You don't have to check. What it is, it's about giving someone who has reached the end of their line, who is so downtrodden that they're even willing to beg for money. It's about giving them hope. It's about giving them a gift which says to them, perhaps things can change around. Perhaps this can be the start of a new path or a new beginning for you in your life. And I think that's the idea of why the story of the Megillah is so central to Matanos Levyonim. A name shall aniyim nesuos b'mikra Megillah. It's not that they're just focused on when the people are there so they can schnarr. It's that they can be uplifted, nesuos b'mikra Megillah. They can be raised up through the story of the Megillah. You hear the story of the Megillah, v'achodesh asher ne'apach me'edo liyom tov, the chodesh which was transformed, the agom l'simchal me'edo liyom tov, the purpose of Matanot Levyonim is to find those Evyonim, those who are being poshet yad, those who are extending their hand, those who are in need of a pick-me-up, to give them Matanot Levyonim. And that's why it's not conventional tzedakah. That's why it's not just about the Suda of Purim. Matanot Levyonim is connected with the story of the Megillah. It's a way of giving hope, taking the message of the Nahapachu from the Megillah, the transformation, the instantaneous transformation, and giving someone who needs that message some hope. I think based on all the things that we've talked about, I hope we haven't gone too fast. We've analyzed the two readings and seen how the second reading, the primary reading, allows us to dig deeper and learn and re-accept the covenant. We've seen the idea that the Mishloach Manot is not just about getting the Jews together, but it's really about the ultimate reconciliation with all the divisions that we've had throughout our history. The Suda of Purim is, again, not just about physical salvation, but about that rededication of the covenant. And lastly, the Matanot Levyonim are a way of taking the Purim story and bringing it into action for those who are in need of that Vina HaPochu message. And hopefully, all these messages will contribute to our Purim, and they help explain, I think, why Purim will forever be a holiday for the Jewish people because of all these deep and ultimately enhancing messages for the holiday that are expressed through the mitzvot. Chag Purim Sameach Chodesh Tov. Yeah, I should have spent more time on that one, huh?
Yeah, well. Yeah. How does that tie all together? You were saying explaining earlier that actually between the brothers and whatever, that Yaakov is, or Mordechai is the Gilgal of Yaakov.
So I think it's all connected. So I think he's on the Gilgal, and he might be the Gilgal of Yaakov.
Where is it? I said that? No, I said that. I would have said that Yaakov down that face of it because of that. He had to write that by not bowing down the
So there's a message which says that actually focuses on the fact that Mordechai explains, I don't have to bow down to you. Because Binyamin didn't bow down to you, he wasn't born. That's what the Medrash says. It doesn't say that he's a Gilgal of Yaakov. I wasn't familiar with that.
I'm
going
to give you regards
to my Scott.
All right.
They're Israel.
All right, yes, I know. How are they doing?
And they have a
baby. Yes, I keep up with her on Gene Chat status. All right, send our regards. My father's in Long Island. He's the rabbi in Lawrence. Oh, wow. Very nice.
All right. That's it.
Yeah, well, I probably should have picked one and not been greedy.
No, it was great.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
I think one thing. I don't know. No,
sure.
It's fine. That's a good overview.
Right.
Now we don't turn anything else. The first one, when you were talking about the learning for this thing. So we know you spoke out of an element that, like, oh, we but also speak of the
patch. Correct, yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. I meant to get that all
also,
in.
Also,
no, we took the phone call Friday. You spoke to someone or not? I'm going to call him today.
So, I mean, like, people like Ariel, whatever. Like, people on the. It's like kind of awkward.
People in TNEC know?
Meaning everyone knows except for people on our program.
Right.
So, like, half of us know, but, like, no one actually addressed it.
Probably should shut this off since.
Oh.